Seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome you all to our second hearing in this new year, and our best wishes to you all for the new year. We have with us, I think, Waupun area high school students. Are they here? Would they stand? Good. Thank you. You may be seated. The students are here with a program, a national award-winning program, by the way, that is sponsored by the state Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. And we've been having this program for a number of years now, and thousands of students have been invited to come and hear oral argument, and thousands have accepted this invitation. Come to the court to hear the oral argument, as you have. And before coming, they've been given materials about the case, and they may have engaged in special activities relating to the case. They come, they listen to oral argument, and then after the oral argument for the second case is finished, they will meet with a justice who is assigned to talk with the students that day. And this has been a very successful program, and we are very, very proud of it, and we're very happy that you all came and also that you didn't face a snowy day in your travels. With those comments stated, I'll first ask a question. Does anyone here want a summary of the case we're about to hear? It's easier to listen to the case if you know something about it. Okay, raise your hand if you want a summary. No hands raised? I'll go to my second point. My second point is to introduce the student to the students and everyone else, the justices of the court. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Robensack. Seated to my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. Seated to my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her right, Justice David Prosser. And Justice Prosser is the justice who will speak with the students at noon. And I forgot to tell the first group that you were going to be the speaker, but I think you can identify yourself. And on my far right is Justice Annette Siegler. With those introductory comments made, I'll call our second case, 09AP806CR, State versus Marvin L. Beauchamp. Representing the defendant, Mr. Beauchamp, is Craig S. Powell, and he will have 25 minutes. We will then hear from Maura F. J. Whalen, who is Assistant Attorney General representing the state, and then 5 minutes to you, Mr. Powell, for rebuttal. You may proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, members of the court. May it please the court, my name is Craig Powell, and I represent the petitioner in this case, Marvin Beauchamp. As early as 1722 into the late 1700s, in English criminal common law courts, those courts admitted statements known as dying declarations against an accused, even though the accused had no opportunity to cross-examine the person making that statement. The courts admitted these statements on the idea that they were inherently reliable. A phrase frequently used by those courts was, no person about to meet his maker would do so with a lie upon his lips. In 2004, in Crawford versus Washington, the United States Supreme Court abandoned years of jurisprudence that permitted the admission of hearsay statements against an accused on the basis that those statements were deemed to be reliable, so that the right to confront those witnesses to cross-examination was not required. The court's rejection of Ohio versus Roberts, which was the hearsay paradigm that allowed that to occur, was based on the Supreme Court and Justice Scalia's view that the Confrontation Clause, as understood, is a procedural guarantee that requires that reliability of evidence be tested in a very specific way, one specific way, and that is cross-examination of the declarant. The upshot of that is Crawford, which says that where an out-of-court statement is testimonial and attempted to be admitted, the declarant must be unavailable and the defendant must have had a prior opportunity to cross-examine that declarant concerning the statement. Without those two things, the statement cannot be admitted and violates the Confrontation Clause.
Well, is this testimonial?
Absolutely.
Why?
Well, for starters, I would say the issue has been waived because it was briefed by me in the Court of Appeals and not responded to by the state at that level. The Court of Appeals assumed they were testimonial but did not decide. I believe that issue has been waived by the state. However, the statements are clearly testimonial if the issue is to be considered. The test put forth in Davis versus Washington and adopted even more broadly by this court in State versus Jensen is whether a reasonable person in the declarant's position would expect that the statement he or she is making would be used in the investigation or prosecution of a crime. That is the test. And in this case, you have a gentleman, Mr. Somerville, who is the deceased. The first statement that is deemed to be a dying declaration in this matter is made to a firefighter who has responded to take care of his injuries. Now, the record indicates that at the time, Mr. Coleman, Marvin Coleman, the firefighter, appears to render aid. Police have already been on the scene because in front of the residence where this happened, 3939 North Sherman Avenue in Milwaukee, there is construction going on, rush hour morning. There's cars backed up in front of the location where this occurs. There just happens to be a police officer, a lieutenant, parked, stuck in the traffic jam nearby when it occurs. She is the first to respond and begin rendering aid to Mr. Beauchamp. Marvin Coleman testifies that it comes over to him on the radio as a shooting. So as he approaches, he understands or has been notified there has been a shooting. When he appears and sees Mr. Somerville, again by happenstance, they know each other.
And his name is Marvin. Did you believe it?
Can't make this stuff up, Your Honor. And he says to Brian Somerville, excuse me, the first thing he says to him, as Mr. Coleman's testimony at trial was, who did this to you? Directly asking the identity of who did this to you. And he says, Marvin. And Marvin Coleman says, who, me? And he says, no, big-headed Marvin. And that's the extent of it there. Mr. Coleman then testifies that his next question does not concern the extent of the injuries, trying to determine what kind of aid he has to render. He says, well, what happened? And Mr. Somerville then explains in brief detail how he believes he was lured outside of a house after an argument and was shot. Those statements are not intended or would not be reasonably foreseen by Mr. Somerville to address an ongoing emergency. At the time that this has happened, the police are already on scene. There are many, many people around. Another witness named Gerard Logan, who watched it all happen from the median, a young boy who was selling water, had told police that the shooter had fled around the house back towards the alley, away from where Mr. Somerville was. These statements made by Mr. Somerville were about what had happened, not what was happening. They are made to an authority figure, a firefighter. The fact that they know each other, I don't think pushes the statements into the non-testimonial arena. I think they're clearly looking at past facts. And the crucial part of the test, as I see it from, as this court articulated in Jensen, is that what a reasonable person in the declarant's position would believe and whether their statement would be used in the investigation or prosecution of a crime. And certainly any person in Mr. Somerville's position would have believed that telling a firefighter after a police officer is already on scene, that a big-head Marvin shot me and he lured me out of the house and I was shot, he would believe and expect those statements to be used in investigating the crime. I think those statements are clearly testimonial.
Counselor, do you think there is any import in our evaluating the intent of the speaker that these are dying declarations rather than a statement that's made where someone got beat up and is not in imminent danger of death?
I take the court's question to mean that the provider, in this case Mr. Coleman, may fear that Mr. Somerville is about to expire, so wants to get some information from him?
No. I think that, I guess to myself, I wonder if someone who is dying really forms the same kind of an expectation of their words and what will happen from what they've said as someone who may be injured but is not in imminent danger of death. Because you're supposed to look at what was the declarant's motivation in speaking. Now, obviously, he's answering a question. That's part of it. But your argument to us was, well, certainly he would think that his statements would be used in prosecution or investigation. But maybe he's not thinking about that at all. He's worrying about, is he going to die? Maybe he's not thinking about how a statement would be used. And if that's the case, or is that the case with someone who is making a dying declaration, in other words, his physical condition, does that bear on his expectation of how what he says will be used?
No, because his expectation, I think if we're looking at or considering the fact that he may be too physically impaired or...
Yeah, to think about how they're going to use it.
So in that sense, he couldn't also form the same intent to trying to leave or notify the police that he's trying to seek help for an ongoing emergency. He's just talking. But in the sense of the questions that he's asking or being asked, it's who did this and what happened, not where are you hurt, is the person nearby, no. Are you afraid? Those sorts of things.
Okay, I'm not maybe saying what I want to have you answer correctly. My concern is that we've got a dying declaration, or at least that's the allegation here. I know there's some tussle about that in the briefs. But just assuming this is a dying declaration, and one of the parts of determining whether something is testimonial is the intent of the speaker in speaking and his belief about how what he says will be used. All of that requires some cognitive ability or focus on a future use of his statement by the speaker, correct? Are we together that far?
Yes.
Okay. Does his cognitive ability to appreciate the use of what he's saying differ in a dying declaration from how you might evaluate the same answers to the same questions by someone who is not so mortally wounded?
I don't think so. Here's why. Here's why I would say that.
Okay.
If we're talking about a dying declaration situation, mm-hmm. the vast majority of times that person will have deceased and died. So that person will never be available for cross-examination.
True.
A person in a lesser case like a battery or something like that will later most likely be available in a situation for cross-examination. Those things are such as motivation, what they intended to get at in their statements can be explored through cross-examination. That's just not available in most dying declarations
cases.
Right,
I agree.
So the person's subjective intent, A, can't really be explored in a dying declarations case. So I don't think it's something that you should or the court should look at in trying to figure out whether the statement is testimonial or not. That's why I think there's an objective test set forth in Davis and Jensen about what a reasonable person in the declarant's position would believe.
But part of declarant's position is he's dying. You see, you can't just say because he answers a question. The declarant's position is someone that's on the verge of death. That position has to be evaluated by us, and that's where I'm kind of wanting some assistance from you.
I apologize, we can't seem to get on the same page on this.
I know.
Maybe I can help by asking the question somewhat differently.
Sure.
Okay? That we're not looking at this declarant, but all reasonable persons who are about to die. I mean, that's our group, right?
Yes.
All right. All reasonable people who are about to die do not have
the thought or are not thinking when they say, big-headed Marvin did it. They don't have the capacity to decide, to say, I'm going to say this thinking it's going to be used in an investigation or prosecution by psychological and medical concepts. Therefore, if that's true, which is what Justice Rogensack is presenting, therefore, if by definition you can't have, if you're dying, a concept that is going to be used in investigation or prosecution, therefore, it is not testimonial. I mean, that's the import of her question, at least to me. Is that the import of your question?
Yeah, that's
yes.
Right.
So are you willing to accept that? And let me just say, if you're willing to accept that the import is that someone who is dying doesn't have the wherewithal to think through whether it's going to be used in investigation or prosecution, that goes to your argument that it's not reliable.
Well,
because of issues relating to dying declaration.
Well,
for me, it doesn't go to reliability.
No, but it
goes
could.
To what kind of an intent he would have at the time he speaks as to how his words will be used.
Right, but when we're talking about a realm of testimonial versus non-testimonial statements, the declarant's subjective intent is not...
Exactly, and that's why I put it as a reasonable, any reasonable person dying.
Right, and so you could have a situation, for example, in a hospital where someone is on their deathbed and there's no police or authority figures around, and they lean over to a loved one and say something along the lines of, tell Jimmy I forgive him, or something like that. And let's say this is a suspicious death later, a suspect named James or Jimmy develops, and that all of a sudden becomes something authorities might be interested in using an investigation or prosecution. That would clearly be non-testimonial because it's a statement made to a family member with no authority figures around, no investigation pending, something like that. Can be non-testimonial. That person may be in their last breath, but making that kind of a statement to a loved one before they expire. So I'm a little concerned because I've got the sense that there's some idea that maybe all dying declarations are going to be testimonial or non-testimonial. I think there.
That's the import of Justice Rogensack's position, that all dying declarations will be non-testimonial. Therefore, you get it out of this rule. You can use it as evidence. The end.
I don't think you can do that. Because dying declarations are not strictly limited to a class of statements that are uttered at the moment before someone dies. They could, in theory, be made a year before or longer. What's required as the foundation is that the person, at the moment they make this statement, believe they're about to die, not that they, in fact, do die. So, really, you could have an attempted homicide case where the victim is walking down the street a year later, before trial, and decides he doesn't want to be involved and splits. Now he's unavailable, okay, but it's not that he's deceased. He's still alive. So I don't think you can formulate a bright-line rule that says all dying declarations are non-testimonial, because I think the test in Davis is appropriate, and as Jensen adopted, I think that's the right rule. I don't think it's blanket or bright-line rule.
And you have kind of a bifurcated focus in deciding whether or not a dying declaration can be admissible. You just have the foundational requirements, which include the declarant is believing that that death is imminent. That's a foundational requirement. But then when you want to put it through whether or not it is testimonial for purposes of confrontation, you go from the subjective to the objective. Am I getting that correct?
I think that's correct. And I will note there is some objective element to the foundational requirement as well, because due to the difficulties in looking at someone's subjective intent, a court is allowed to look at the totality of the circumstances surrounding the person's injuries, how they occurred, to accept the foundation for a dying declaration.
That death is imminent.
Yes. It doesn't have to be proven absolutely through subjective intent or belief of the declarant, but it can be done through objective circumstances, but that's right.
Mr. Powell, yes. Let me go at this way. Let's assume that these are dying declarations, that they are testimonial. Why is there not, then, an exception to the Crawford confrontation rule? Certainly there appears to be language in Crawford and in Giles that would support this being an exception to the confrontation requirement of Crawford. Why are you taking the opposite position?
Because I think what's notable about Crawford, first of all, is the express the refusal or to accept the invitation to do it. Everything else is right there in Crawford, including the statement in the footnote that the existence of dying declarations at the common law cannot be disputed. I don't dispute it here. If the Supreme Court was going to say that dying declarations are, frankly, the only exception to the Confrontation Clause, even though that issue was not precisely before the Court, they had every opportunity to do so. Instead, the Court said, we do not need to decide the issue here, and we decline to do so. It's an open question. Now, why it's not barred by Crawford is contained right within Crawford itself. The question presented in Crawford was whether the procedure for a judicial determination of reliability complied with the Sixth Amendment's right of confrontation. In the course of answering that question, Justice Scalia and the Court undertook a historical review because they had to review what they deemed to be the ambiguous phrase, witnesses against the accused. And from that, they determined two things. First, that the Confrontation Clause was put in place to prevent ex parte examinations, the abuses of the Marion statutes where depositions were taken outside the presence of the accused and later admitted in court. From there, Justice Scalia and the Court ruled that witnesses against, therefore, does not mean simply a body in a witness stand testifying. It applies to out-of-court statements as well. The second thing the historical analysis showed was that it's a procedural guarantee, which means that the guarantee is not that evidence against someone be reliable. It's that it be tested in one way, and that is through cross-examination. And a lot of that is consumed in the first part of the Crawford opinion, which a lot of the cases that have looked at this question, dying declarations post-Crawford, they stick to the footnote 6 and the line that says, so the most natural reading of the Confrontation Clause in the Constitution is that it admits those exceptions that existed at common law. But is almost a total neglect for the entire second part of the opinion, which I think is the core holding of Crawford, which is that judicial determinations of reliability are not germane or not acceptable under the Confrontation Clause. That's Ohio versus Roberts, and that was essentially abrogated in terms of testimonial statements in Crawford. And the opinion went to a great length to explain how that did not comport with the understanding of confrontation and cross-examination. So we look at dying declarations, we look at what they were at 1791, which is the year Crawford, and we tend to accept as the founding and the date we choose when looking back at it. And that is, these statements were admitted, the only statements that were admitted without a chance to cross-examine them by the accused, because they were deemed to be inherently reliable. The equivalent of an oath, therefore, a cross-examination is not necessary because they are deemed to be trustworthy. That is in complete contradiction with the second part of the Crawford opinion, and the abrogation of Ohio versus Roberts.
What about Giles? Doesn't Giles add to the position taken by the state here?
No, Giles mentions dying declarations again in passing, noting that it might be an exception. But what Giles does, interestingly, is looks back at the other, I don't want to call it an exception to the Confrontation Clause because it wasn't. It's a forfeiture, as the Crawford Court indicated, and I want to point this out because the Crawford Court explicitly said forfeiture by wrongdoing existed then, and which we adopt. In Crawford, they took the opportunity to adopt forfeiture by wrongdoing there. Again, didn't do that for dying declarations, so I think it's clearly an open question. However, forfeiture by wrongdoing, which is what Giles addressed, specifically is different from dying declarations because it's an equitable remedy. It is not an alternative means of assessing reliability. Those are Justice Scalia's words from Crawford. But dying declarations are. The foundation required for a dying declaration is that the person believe they are about to die, because that, in the ancient court's view, meant that whatever was going to come out of their mouth at that point was going to be the truth, capital T, truth. But respectfully, there is no class of evidence, I submit to this court, that can be deemed to be inherently reliable, so that it is beyond question, literally beyond question.
Counsel?
Yes.
If I understand you correctly, your view is dying declarations can be both testimonial and non-testimonial. I know I'm circling back to some of the first questions. But why isn't this statement one where the primary purpose was to enable police to assist to meet an ongoing emergency, like in Davis versus Washington, thus rendering it outside of the testimonial spectrum?
Okay. Well, if we look at Davis versus Washington, there you have a 911 call where the speaker, the declarant, is saying, essentially, I'm being attacked at this very moment.
Okay. So if it's, in your view, if it's after the fact, I've already been shot, then it cannot be an ongoing emergency?
Yes, and I believe that comes...
It has to be, I'm about to be shot.
Well, no.
Fat-headed Marvin's about to shoot me, boom, then it's an ongoing emergency.
Well, if the police were lucky enough to get that phone call, I suppose. But,
I don't know, I'm just trying to figure it out.
As Davis says, we're talking about events that are happening, as in Davis, versus events, describing events that have happened.
So okay. The emergency is not ongoing when he's laying there on the sidewalk with bullets in his chest.
Yes, and police already on the scene. Before he makes that statement, police are on the scene. Okay. So it's not as if Mr. Coleman is the first officer to arrive and it's chaotic and there's no one else there. There's no indication they smell gunpowder, as in one of these other cases cited by the state. He's lying there. Police have already been there. The scene is secure. And he's asked, who did it and what happened?
Why isn't it an excited utterance for the same reasons?
Well, maybe it could be, but then you'd still have to undergo the non-testimonial versus testimonial inquiry. If it's non-testimonial, in my view, it would come in as a dying declaration or probably excited utterance. I'm not here to say dying declarations are not a firmly rooted hearsay exception. They clearly are. They've been around for hundreds of years. But I think it is clear that these statements are testimonial and that dying declarations... testimonial dying declarations and their admission is inconsistent with Crawford and its abrogation of the reliability.
Now, you cite, or the state cites, numerous courts who agree with the state, and there's a federal case that agreed with you. But the U.S. Supreme Court has not ruled directly on this issue, right?
That's
correct. Am I right?
That's correct.
Okay. That's a lead up to my question, namely, there's a United States Supreme Court case pending now, that's Michigan versus Bryant.
Yes.
Which deals with whether a statement made by a victim is testimonial, right?
Yes.
It's not a dying declaration.
That's right.
I understand the case. But comes under what?
In that case, the prosecutor attempted to get the evidence in as an excited utterance. In that case, the deceased was in a gas station parking lot. Police showed up. He said, I've been shot about 30 minutes ago over at this location down the street. He's mortally wounded. There was, as I understand it, at trial, the prosecutor, I'm sorry, the red light is on. Should I finish?
Complete the answer.
The prosecutor claimed, well, it's an excited utterance and dying declaration. The trial court said, well, you're going to have to give me some foundation for either one of those. Prosecutor chose the excited utterance. It was admitted, ultimately reversed by the Michigan Supreme Court. In that case, it's pending. And as the court has mentioned it, in the oral argument in that case about 90 days ago, Justice Scalia said...
And that's important because he's written what?
Crawford
and Giles.
Right? And Davis.
So you think that's what they're assigning it to him. He's become a confrontation testimonial expert.
Seems to be his cup of tea. In In a discussion with the lawyer representing the defendant in that case, Justice Ginsburg asked the lawyer to assume that dying declarations were an exception to confrontation clause, though the justices admit it being an open question. And the lawyer dutifully responded to the question, and Justice Scalia asked him, Mr. Van Heck, which is the counsel's name, what is the basis for your concession that a dying declaration is an exception from the confrontation clause? And as Mr. Van Heck attempts to say, I didn't concede it, they go on, but Mr. Scalia ultimately says, it hasn't been reached. If it's not an established exception to the confrontation clause, there's no basis for saying, therefore, the confrontation clause pertains only to reliability. It pertains to the opportunity to cross-examine. And reliability exceptions are what we used to do under Reynolds. I think he misspoke and meant to say Roberts. If it was reliable, we let it in. And Mr. Van Heck says yes, and Scalia continues, and the mere fact that it's reliable as a dying declaration instead of reliable as something else ought to have nothing to do with the confrontation clause decision. So while that was not a dying declaration's case, the issue came up, and I think it's notable, as Madam Chief Justice mentioned, that comment came from no less authority on Crawford than Justice Scalia himself.
Yeah, but justices say things in oral argument to get discussion rolling. You might think I agree with what I'm saying, but you may think that I think Bryant is different. I may think it's exactly the same as this case. I just want you to talk with me about that.
Sure.
So, you know.
Well, I think the Michigan Supreme Court got it right there in terms of being a testimonial statement in that regard.
And I will ask this of Ms. Whalen, who says this is not testimonial. And it seems as if you gave the standard of what's testimonial in terms of the declarant's reasonable belief. When you look on page 25 of Ms. Whalen's brief, and there's a reference to Davis. In fact, it's a quote from Davis. This is what's not testimonial. Statements are not testimonial when made in the course of a police interrogation, which is here, right?
That's correct.
Under circumstances objectively indicating, and we're using the objective test, are you right?
Yes.
Indicating that the primary purpose of the interrogation is to enable police assistance to meet an ongoing emergency. That looks at it from the interrogator's standpoint.
Yes, but later in Davis, the case says the declarant's statements are what we evaluate.
For testimonial.
Right.
But for non-testimonial, we look at the cop.
Well, I think you look at him for both. I mean, it's the same inquiry.
That's what I'm asking you.
Yeah, it's the same inquiry of the same person. What you're looking at is the declarant's state of mind objectively.
Right. And you're looking at the interrogator's state of mind. Is the interrogator seeking assistance to meet an ongoing emergency? And you're arguing in this case that in Michigan versus Bryant, it's not an ongoing emergency. It's 30 minutes, and he's no longer even on the scene.
Right, and that's where Davis lists four factors, one of which is whether the event is happening or has happened. That is a critical part of the test. And in this case, it had already happened.
So it doesn't fit under the emergency provision. If it's going to go anywhere, it's going dying declaration. That's your position.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thanks.
Assistant Attorney General Whalen.
May it please the Court, I appear for the State. Just to respond on the last point, I think that whose intent we're looking at, it does seem confused in the Davis cases. I felt the same thing that you do. If we're talking about, for instance, the part of Bryant and the other cases that I cite in the brief that justifies looking at this as an ongoing emergency in terms of identifying the assailant is, in fact, Marvin Beauchamp is out on the streets with a gun. Let's be concerned about that as an ongoing emergency, both for the rest of the citizenry and the investigating officers. Now, Obviously, I think that your implication is correct, that it's the officer's intent. Why am I asking this? Why do I think it's relevant to remedying an ongoing emergency? I don't think that Somerville at that point is concerned about the future harm Beauchamp might cause. So I think that the law is a bit confused on that point.
Yeah, I have another question for you. As I read your brief, it is not the state's position that all dying declarations are non-testimonial because the declarant can't have this intent. This is a restatement of the conversation that Justice Robinsack and I had.
Until Justice Robinsack asked that question, I hadn't thought about that approach, which I think is a very interesting one and obviously is really keyed on the whole what is the declarant thinking. So I think it's a really good observation.
You'd have to say that for every dying declaration.
Exactly.
As a reason. And so that would make it non-testimonial. Is the state willing to take that position? And what's your authority?
I think that if we're really going to make the focus on what the I wouldn't go that far, because I think that even, let's say in this case, I didn't argue that his statement to the police officer in the emergency room was non-testimonial. Mm-hmm. And I think that under Justice Robinsack's analysis that perhaps I could have. Whereas I think that if the dying declaration was sort of like the one about I forgive Jimmy, but a little different, which is a month later, after realizing that they're trying to catch who it is, and I still haven't turned over my brother, but they might be fingering other people unfairly, et cetera, that then I say to an officer who has come to talk to me one last time trying to get something out of me, on my deathbed I say, Jimmy did it. At that point, I think that would be clearly testimonial, whereas even the statement here in the hospital room might be non-testimonial if you're really going to focus on what is a dying person's objective intent.
You're not willing to advocate a flat rule.
No.
Okay.
No.
I just want to clarify that issue.
And I just wanted to point out that, and I guess the court is not concerned about this, I don't know, but that I don't think that my raising the Michigan versus Bryant issue is waived, both because as the respondent we are entitled to raise issues that are going to affirm the trial court, but more importantly, I couldn't have raised this issue in the Court of Appeals because I feel that although we might have made the testimonial argument in the Court of Appeals, under certain language in Jensen, and I think even under Davis, it would have been a very challenging argument to make when we had what was a really strong argument, whereas once Michigan versus Bryant came before the United States Supreme Court, I think that it really potentially changed the landscape. Who knows?
Well, why would we have taken this case if we didn't take it for the testimonial issue?
Well, for the dying declaration issue, I assume.
But what I mean by that is under the whole test of Crawford.
Oh, yes, of course. Oh, yeah, right. Well, I mean, that's true, but, you know, we still want to win the case, even if...
You don't want to waive the case.
Right.
And what's left if you waive the whole concept of Crawford?
Oh, no. I mean, the question wasn't whether I'd waive Crawford. The question is whether I raise testimonial.
Okay, well, here's my question on that and a question on Bryant. Mm-hmm. This court sometimes proceeds headlong and makes a decision, even when we know there's a case pending in the United States Supreme Court that will cover an issue that we have, or the main issue we have. We might wait to mandate it until the last minute in June, because await that court decision. Other times, this court puts on hold an issue that is pending in the United States Supreme Court. I'm not sure that we're consistent in our proceeding, but that's not the relevant issue. The relevant issue I have for you is, should this court decide this case now or wait until Bryant comes out?
Well, in my opinion, I think that our core argument, the one responding to Beauchamp's core argument, is a very strong argument, and I think that, we should win on that. So therefore, I don't really think it's necessary for does the state win to hold on to it. I think that if I were on the court, I would probably want to hold it just because I would want to deal with both issues. But I don't think it's necessary.
Well, you think that Bryant will raise the issue of Diane Declaration? Or is it that you think the court, in deciding the issue in Bryant, might make some language, put in another footnote, say we don't address the dying declaration?
Oh, what no, is it? I don't think that. I think that the importance of the Bryant case is if the court were, if four members of the court were to decide that dying declarations, unconfronted declarations, violate Crawford, then Bryant, if Bryant was decided favorably to the state, that would be offer an alternative basis on which to affirm the Court of Appeals decision and the conviction.
Let me make sure that I understand your argument. I understand or understood your argument to be that for historical reasons, the historical reason being that dying declarations were admissible prior to 1791, mm-hmm. prior to there being a right, constitutional mm-hmm. right to confrontation, that for historical reasons, the right to confrontation is not implicated mm-hmm. when you have a dying declaration. It's admissible. It's mm-hmm. admissible because it came before and the constitutional right to confrontation, and the constitutional right to confrontation doesn't apply in the analysis. You don't get to whether or not it's the Crawford testimonial stuff or non-testimonial stuff because Crawford doesn't apply because the right to confrontation doesn't apply to dying declarations. That's your argument.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, one of the responses by your opposing counsel is, look, forget Crawford. Forget all this stuff. Dying declaration no longer has sufficient indicia of reliability to be a recognized hearsay exception. It no longer has sufficient indicia of reliability because it used to be that everyone was religious and they thought they were going to meet their maker and wouldn't lie right before they get to those pearly gates. That doesn't apply anymore. Get with it, court. I mean, he's not saying it that way. He's much more respectful. So let me withdraw that comment. The second thing he's saying is it was admissible when that used to be the only kind of evidence available. And so you made some choices and you said, okay, in before 1791, that's the only testimony you would have as to the cause of death. Now we have scientific advances, we have DNA, we have surveillance, we have all sorts of other ability to show the cause of death other than the solely relying on dying declaration. So, things evolve, he says. Mm-hmm. It no longer has sufficient indicia of reliability and should no longer be a recognized hearsay exception. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think I have three responses. First of all, although when I read his opening brief, I believe that to be his argument, and I think that I responded to that argument at length in my brief by saying, A, He is presuming without evidence that our religious views have changed. Maybe it's correct, but we don't know. That has not been shown here. And that I did not reply really to this sort of necessity best evidence argument, because I believe that was not one of the reasons, that was not a concern of the founders. So I don't want to get involved with that. I mean, I might be interested in that in other parts of the analysis or the critique, but not in terms of what the founders were saying. Only one of the ancient sources I read, I think it was in the East Treatise, said, well, these are admitted by necessity, and then goes on to explain because we think it's like an oath and because meeting the maker. So it turns out that in the earliest reference to necessity I can find, it's really a religious rationale. So I didn't go there. So I think that I really lay out in the brief why this attack on the original rationale doesn't work, because it's unsupported. I also think, this is going to be my third argument, but I'll be my second argument, that really the analysis is set out in Crawford and Giles doesn't care about that. The analysis set out in Crawford and Giles says what, and this is language that is in the Crawford opinion. I think it's the, one of the pieces of language that counsel said all of these state courts are wrongly relying on, but it is what it says, that, no, I don't have it here, but that we take the confrontation clause with the exceptions that were attached to it at the founding. That, to me, means we just take them and we don't question them and don't attack them. Now, and we take this exception even if it doesn't agree with our current policy positions. I was thinking to myself, well, do we have other kinds of times when we take an originalist approach to the federal Constitution and look at what the framers thought, regardless of what we think at the present time? And I think that the Second Amendment case, which the name escapes me at the moment, presents a good example of this. Gun control in the 20th century, particularly in urban areas, is an issue that presents policy views, and those policy views are based on the way we live now, that you may agree or disagree with gun control advocates, but I think you have to agree that they are making policy arguments based on a 20th century or 21st century realities of life that are foreign to the 18th century realities of life. Whereas every homeowner may have had a gun in his home in Boston in 1777, and that was considered perfectly normal, that's not true in Boston in 1997. When the U.S. Supreme Court finally looked at the Second Amendment and confronted all of this debate that's been simmering for decades, the court did not say, well, let's look at the policy arguments. Should Chicago be allowed to restrict the use and ownership of firearms? Or is the policy argument that that a good citizen should be allowed to protect himself? In fact, no, those policy arguments are not of interest to the U.S. Supreme Court in analyzing what the framers intended in the 18th century. So similarly, here, if the court, since the Supreme Court has taken a historical approach to interpreting the Confrontation Clause, whether the policies underlying the Dying Declaration exception no longer hold doesn't matter to the historical exception. And I had a third response about what I think his argument really is. I don't think it's what you and I originally thought, but it's what he opened his argument with today in arguing that Crawford rejected the Roberts reliability standard for admitting unconfronted hearsay. And then he observes also that unconfronted dying declarations were admissible at common law because they were deemed, quote, inherently reliable. And I think that certainly, for example, in the Bryant argument, Justice Kennedy uses that very language, so I'll accept that premise. So he puts these two things together and concludes that because historically based on reliability, the common law dying declaration exception doesn't survive Crawford's rejection of, and this is where his argument falls apart, the rejection of the Roberts reliability standard. And Beauchamp misconstrues Crawford. Crawford overruled Roberts because it's general and amorphous, and the court kept saying judge-made reliability standard was ahistorical and foreign to the framers' understanding. Crawford wrote that the common law authorities did not acknowledge any, and this is the court's language, general reliability exception to the common law rule. Therefore, Roberts' general reliability approach was ahistorical. In contrast, dying declarations constituted a specific reliability exception to the common law rule. Thus, as understood by the framers, dying declarations were and are an exception to the Confrontation Clause.
You know, I see our rules of evidence and exceptions kind of not necessarily tied to the Constitution or constitutional analysis or original intent of the Constitution. I mean, we have admissibility questions with regard to business records. That has evolved because the way of keeping business records is no longer the shopkeeper in the 1600s. We have admissibility issues with regard to video depositions that didn't exist before. So, and the business records, perhaps the reliability of business records has to be looked at again for the business records exception to the hearsay rule because of the way we keep business records now. Who knows? But I don't think it's tied to constitutional analysis generally. Mm-hmm. Kind of when I look at the rules of evidence and but for the interplay in something like a confrontational issue, I don't think it's a fundamental part of the analysis of what existed at 1700 or 1800 mm-hmm. or 1900 as to how we're going to do it today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah.
Are dying declarations reliable?
Well, I think that I don't know. I think that, and I was thinking earlier, how could we really research this and test this? And I think that we would have to get a group of subjects who sincerely thought they were dying and then didn't die, because otherwise how could we interview them? And these subjects would have also had to have made statements, and we would have to evaluate whether these statements were reliable. And so I don't know whether they are reliable. I think I cite in my brief the advisory committee notes and Wigmore and a Pennsylvania Supreme Court case saying that there is this human thing that we have, that we are not, that faced with the awe of death, we are not going to lie, regardless of our religious beliefs. Now,
let me ask you this.
I find that persuasive, but
it seems to me, and I'm going to put this right out, to the extent that dying declarations have been linked to religious belief,
mm-hmm.
In the view of some people, undermines its validity. But now let me give you a hypothetical. Let us say you have shot me in the chest,
which I would
twice. Once in the abdomen, once in the left hip, and once in the upper back. You've done that. Okay, I'm lying there, an authority figure asks, who shot you? And I say, Mr. Powell. What is the logic to that?
Mm-hmm. Well, there I don't think you're, I don't understand, but I don't think you're criticizing the religious rationale there, are you? You're criticizing the perception problem or the error.
I'm saying that some people are saying because there was a religious rationale mm-hmm. for this, that it can't be legitimate. But I'm saying whether it's a religious rationale or any other kind of a rationale, if you just shot me five times and I'm about to die, and I'm saying, please don't let me die, why would, and that moment, why would I say, Mr. Powell shot me?
Oh, yeah, well, that's right. That I completely agree with you. And after I had said, I was starting to think that, maybe I'm reading your mind, because I started to think that very point as you were asking the question. This idea that a person, religious or not, would deliberately name the wrong party is pretty mind-boggling. I mean, I think in one of the scholarly articles they say, well, you know, they might lie to protect their brother, Jimmy, who had shot them. And it is possible that they would lie to protect Jimmy by saying, I don't know who it was, but would they lie and say it was Bobby? That seems, again, we're just being hypothetical.
You're just guessing, aren't you?
Exactly, we are just guessing.
I mean, here, when you're talking about it earlier, I'm a mother. God forbid my kid would shoot me. But I can see... I can see, as a mother, in a dying declaration, deflecting the blame. You know, I can see that happening. It depends on what emotion is strongest. Is it? I think it's possible that revenge in some situation can be strongest. I'm going to get him. It's the Hatfield and McCoys.
Big-headed Marvin sold my son drugs. That's why he's shot.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, that kind of thing. So it depends on what emotion is the strongest and most compelling. I think generally it's going to be a dying declaration is going to be the truth. That makes sense to me. But the question is, does it have sufficient indicia of reliability to always admit it?
Well, the first thing is that under the historical analysis, that doesn't matter. So, but the second thing is that, tried to set this out in my brief, a lot of these criticisms of the dying declarations are good grounds for impeachment. And I think that it's likely if someone, for instance, Marvin sold Somerville, let's say, some fatal drug dose, and so that's why he actually didn't know who shot him, but he thought, this is the last thing I can do for my son. I can finger Marvin, even though Marvin's not guilty for that. Well, it seems to me that that's something that could probably be impeached. If his motive to wrongly name someone was strong enough and based on something, that you could probably, a good defense counsel and good investigators would be able to impeach that.
Counsel, the thought occurs that the nature of this discussion that's occurring in the form of a colloquy is reflective of why the United States Supreme Court, for instance, in Crawford, noted that one deviation from the general rule of mandatory confrontation involves dying declarations. In Giles, the court noted that dying declarations, quote, were admitted in common law even though they were unconfronted, unquote. There's other language, too. What is the earliest, in your research, how far back in time does that recognition of the dying declaration as an exception to the hearsay rule go?
Well, I think 1722 in the King versus reason. I mean, I'm pretty sure 1722 is right. That, I'm recalling was what I saw as the earliest hearsay recognition, but I wasn't that concerned with the hearsay recognition because I was more concerned, and I think that the constitutional question is, what's the earliest unconfronted hearsay? And this is in both of our briefs, I'm sure. But
95.
No, more like 1791 or so. King versus Woodcock, 1789, and King versus Radburn, 1787. And in that case, I have written in a parenthetical that the basis for the admitting the statement was not stated, but it was clear that that was a valid basis. But there was an alternative possibility that they could have used, and it wasn't clear to me.
Has there been any language in any subsequent United States Supreme Court rulings inconsistent with those principles?
None. And one of the interesting things about the historical approach, whether or not you're an originalist as a general matter, that I found interesting reading the 19th century cases, specifically United States versus Maddox, but even our own cases in Wisconsin and several other state court cases, two of which I cite from Tennessee and Virginia, I think, is that those cases all analyzed the confrontation question the way that Crawford analyzes it, which is that we go back to what the founders thought and we take the sort of the encumbrances that were on the confrontation right at the founding, and that's how we interpret the clause. I mean, and in fact, Maddox was interesting by saying that if we don't interpret it that way, and if in fact we were to jettison the dying declaration exception, we would be creating a new right that in fact was not created by the Sixth Amendment, because the Sixth Amendment only codified as or constitutionalized guarantees that existed at that time. And then there have been a couple of subsequent cases, the United States versus Carver, which was 1897, and so.
Counsel, I want to shift you a little bit because Sure. Your yellow light is on and there is another issue, and
Yeah. Opposing
counsel will want to maybe take a minute or two on it in rebuttal. And my question to you is in regard to the use of prior inconsistent statements. We've been asked by opposing counsel to adopt the Vogel test, which has been around for quite a long time, on prior inconsistent statements. And my question to you is, have you been made aware in your work professionally of problems with our current test for whether and how we use prior inconsistent statements at trial?
No, I have not. And I think that particularly in the context of a greater confrontation issue, it seems that our system, which is the witnesses are in court, they are confronted. They're every version of their story is put before the jury and they're cross-examined. It seems like a very good system and one that is not very complicated. But I really feel there's a very fundamental problem with that argument. As I argued in my brief and as the Court of Appeals found, this error was unpreserved, and therefore it has to be evaluated under either the plain error or the ineffective assistance of counsel doctrines. I mean, I think that's, a black letter for us. In the Supreme Court, Beauchamp has not even acknowledged that reality and has failed to brief either the plain error or the ineffective, and I'll just finish this sentence or two, ineffective assistance issues. I would remind everybody that the burden is on the party seeking error to prove plain error and to prove ineffective assistance of counsel. And I would therefore conclude that if you don't even bother to argue that you have clearly failed to meet your burden, and that the court should not review the issue on the merits.
Counsel, one, to take you back to the key issue, is there any other hearsay exception that in your research you found was in existence before the adoption of the Bill of Rights?
My research, I would say no. There is no other exception. And because I'm not a specialist in the area, you know, you can take that as far as it goes. However, I read many law review articles, and I cite one in my brief that I thought was very excellent, not only because it agreed with me, but it, I mean, I really felt it was an excellent article. And that article concluded not only that it was in existence, but that it was, in fact, the only exception.
What about excited utterance?
No.
But isn't that the issue that you said in Bryant, that if the Supreme Court were to decide in favor of the state, that would be an alternate avenue for us to affirm the state here?
That's right, because if depending on how Bryant goes, if the statement to EMT Coleman is deemed non-testimonial, okay, that would be the first question that I would have to get a yes answer to. Yeah, it's non-testimonial. Okay, then once we agree that it's non-testimonial, well, what hearsay exception? It still has to have a valid hearsay exception. And then I argue that the valid hearsay exception would be excited utterance. But by the time we're talking about that, we've put the Crawford problem to the side because we've decided it's non-testimonial.
No, that's just another way of avoiding it. You say it's non-testimonial, or you say it's an exception to Crawford.
No, I'm saying that it...
I understand.
Yeah, I mean, we're alternative arguments.
Right. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Powell?
Thank you. I want to return quickly to Justice Prosser's point or question. Are they reliable? And I think Ms. Whalen was about right, and I think the answer is you can't say one way or the other. When talking about a class of evidence or statements, you can't say they are reliable or they are unreliable. They are just evidence. And reliability is to be tested in open court on the witness stand through cross-examination. That's what Crawford says. When we talk about the religious basis, I don't agree that maybe some people do say, well, it was has a religious basis, so therefore it doesn't matter. But that is not my argument.
Didn't you cite law review articles that made that argument?
Sure, that was one point. The original belief was that was based in religion, the religious view that if you're about to meet God, you will not lie. But that is just one view. That is the basis for the ultimate conclusion 200 years ago, that these statements were reliable. That's why they were deemed to be reliable. The main point was that they were deemed to be reliable, meaning at that time, trustworthy or true. But as Professor Friedman pointed out in an article that I cited in my brief, that doesn't go to the issue, it only goes to the issue, as he called it, of sincerity, not ability to perceive, meaning was the person so injured that they couldn't accurately see what had happened to them or what kind of position they were in. Was it dark, light out from where they were standing, from their perspective? That rationale doesn't cover that whole swath of inquiry you can go to on cross-examination that gets at the credibility or truthfulness of a statement. So that's where we come back to the historical analysis, which is that the historical analysis which the state puts forth in virtually every case who has addressed this issue since Crawford has put forth is it is now because it was then. But history and reliability are inextricably linked in this case for that very reason. Historically, they were accepted because they were deemed to be reliable. So if this court is going to accept now the historical argument that they existed then, so they were meant to be excluded by the Confrontation Clause or allowed to be included by the Confrontation Clause, and then that essentially is saying, yes, these statements are reliable. We'll accept that. But I do want to note one case Ms. Whalen mentioned was Maddox, and here is where you see sort of a change from the reliance on religious language to what I have called necessity and what Professor Pillale in the Law Review article I cited refers to as necessity, where in Maddox They say these types of statements, dying declarations, are admitted out of the necessities of the case to avoid a failure of justice or a manifest injustice occurring. To me, that means one thing, and that's an acquittal. Don't know what else it could mean. And that's been the sort of the movement of the rationale from 1789 to 1895 when Maddox was considered to very paucity of cases basically decided on the issue between 1895 and Crawford, where you see an outcropping of cases after the issue is decided and this becomes germane again. Where history, I think, is important, and Ms. Whalen, I think, was referring to the Heller case, the gun case. But I think another more recent case is more on point for that issue, and that is Georgia versus Randolph, Fourth Amendment case, where Justice Scalia and his dissent, in a bit of back and forth with Justice Stevens, who has a concurrence in that case, in an originalist back and forth, I'll say, Justice Scalia notes that, yes, we're talking about the Constitution, which is an unchanging document, but that document refers to law that does change. And his example was in the Fourth Amendment context. Originally, it was tied, your right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures was tied to property rights, common law property rights. And common law property rights have changed and altered over the years until today. So as Justice Scalia pointed out in that opinion, someone who may not have had a property right recognized back then and would have no standing to challenge a search may have the ability to do that now under the change of the common law. So the Constitution doesn't change, but the law that it references and relies upon does change, and that affects how we understand the Constitution and the right it conveys. And that's
Counselor, before you're finished, I'd like to give you the opportunity to say a few words about your second issue, if you care to do that. And that my question to you would be the same as to opposing counsel. Are you aware of problems with the use of our current test set out in State versus Nellis on the use of prior inconsistent statements? And then also you might want to respond to opposing counsel's argument that you had the burden to argue it was plain error or ineffective assistance, and you didn't do either, so we shouldn't consider that at all.
Well, in regards to the first part of it, in terms of specific issues in my experience, I would say no. But you look at the genesis for that rule in Vogel versus Percy was a Supreme Court case from 1940s. I believe it was Burr or Burke. I'm not sure. It's listed in Percy itself. But it dealt with the concern that the substantive use of prior inconsistent statements sort of raised the specter of someone being convicted on the basis of unsworn out-of-court statements as opposed to live in-court testimony. And the justices at that time felt that that was violative of due process concerns. And so in the federal rules of evidence, they don't allow the substantive use of it. We do in Wisconsin. But that is how the due process test developed, because in most cases when we're talking about prior inconsistent statements, we're talking about statements made to police officers, which, as cases like Miranda have shown, are an inherently coercive environment and are not much like dying declarations, are not entitled to the presumption of reliability. However, if you look at the evidentiary committee notes to 97209, which adopted the change to Wisconsin's law allowing the substantive use of them, they noticed how this would be a beneficial thing for prosecutors faced with a recalcitrant witness at a preliminary examination. So I think, A, to me, that shows a bias to the state. B, it implies the idea that someone who makes a statement to a police officer out of court, not sworn, not under oath, but comes into court and says something different under oath is probably lying under oath. So that's was the genesis for the change. I think the Percy test provides an avenue to test that and to ensure that excessive use or improper use substantively of prior inconsistent statements does not deprive a defendant of the right to a fair trial. I think the Percy test does that adequately and should be asked this court to adopt. Now, the trial attorney in this case did not object to the admission of those statements on that ground. It was briefed. plain error was briefed previously. I see in my brief now it was not. I do allege previously that it was plain error because it's a fundamental right we're talking about, the right to a fair trial. I would concede here that's not briefed in my current brief. I would ask the Court to still consider it under the plain error standard despite that omission.
Counsel, I know you read lights on, but I want to take you back when you were interrupted by a question talking about the Constitution doesn't change, but the law upon which it may be based may change. And
yes.
I'm assuming that you were going on to say that the Constitution allows for confrontation and that at that time that it was adopted, you assume that the states that adopted the Bill of Rights knew the common law, which is a big assumption, but let's make it. Let's assume the common law is as stated, that the common law of reliability of dying declarations has changed or might be changed, because what was viewed as reliability in the 18th century on the basis of assumptions, whether they be religious or moral or psychological, that now we may have different views of moral, religious, or psychological. Is that your point there? Or have I missed it totally?
Yes, no. I think that as our understandings have changed and developed over 200 years, I think it's fair to say, it may be a truism, that there is no such thing as a class of statements that are reliable or unreliable. Whereas in 1789, I think that was a consistent and obviously widely held belief. I don't think that can be sustained today. And essentially,
scientific matter. Sustained as a scientific matter.
Well, yes, but we talk about running experiments on people who are about to pass and statements they make and trying to determine if there's a percentage that may be reliable or unreliable. It's just not workable. Really, dying declarations are not special. They're just another form of hearsay and should be treated as such as they were under Crawford. There's no rationale that supports treating them differently. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Powell, and thank you, Ms. Whalen, for your arguments in what is a continuing issue before the U.S. Supreme Court and before all the state courts, namely, what does Crawford mean in each of these cases that comes up that isn't directly a fact situation that's already been covered. So thank you for your arguments and for your briefs. That concludes our hearing in 09-AP-806-CR, State versus Marvin L. Beauchamp. And students may remain. They may be joined by other students, and Justice Prasso will be out momentarily to talk with you. Everybody's invited to stay for the session. We are in recess until 1:30 when we will hear our third case.